Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to be a hero in 21st century America, and what does it say about our society that we seem to want and need them so badly? Hero narratives have been part of the human experience since ancient times, treasured and embellished and passed down through the generations. Our first heroes were quite literally gods, followed by those who led warriors to victory. Today, our notion of who is a hero has expanded to the extent that we routinely bestow the title on athletes, civil servants, single parents, teachers, and literally every member of the U.S. Armed Forces. So how does this changed definition of hero affect the role of heroes in our society, and what do we expect from those to whom we give the title? Sean Treat is assistant professor of rhetoric at the University of North Texas. Ben Fountain is the author of the critically acclaimed novel Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And Michael Mooney wrote a profile of slain Navy sniper Chris Kyle for the current issue of D Magazine. Welcome, all of you, to Think.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello.
Sean, we'll actually start with you. What is the classic definition of the word hero?
Well, from the Greek, the hero was a mortal that was sometimes, as you said, half god. From that parentage, and they were the doer of deeds. They did incredible things. They were often warriors, and they were known not just for their skills in hunting or skills in war, but also for their all-around excellence. And so oftentimes for the Greeks, this was very much tied to an issue of character.
So even today, it seems that persists, that we, when we call someone a hero, we believe that they are of strong character.
And they embody our noblest traits as a culture. Yes, absolutely. They represent our aspirations.
That's a tough thing to expect of someone to sort of come back from achieving some great goal and then live the rest of their lives on the highest possible moral plane.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing we're trying to grapple with the veterans who are coming back from these wars at Iraq and Afghanistan is the fact that there's a dark side to heroism. And I think the great classical authors actually get into that in a very profound way. I mean, Homer in the Odyssey, I think he gets into a lot of, you know, the dark side of being a hero. And our culture being what it is, I think we would much prefer to ignore that dark side and to the detriment of our society and to the young men and women who are coming home from those wars.
Well, it's gotten to where it almost seems disrespectful to question anything about a person that has been declared by someone a hero. And it seems like, you know, academics and novelists and journalists, it's in our nature to question everything. But I wonder about, Michael Mooney, how you grappled with that sort of thing when you were writing about Chris Kyle.
Yeah, that's a really tricky area. He's the biggest American hero of our lifetime, war hero wise, and he's a hero of an unpopular war. So there was a lot of really tricky territory. I had a hard time, honestly, when I was face to face with him. I didn't want to question anything in a really skeptical, cynical way, because in some ways I felt honored just to be around him. And that's the way our society deals with that in a lot of ways, is there's such honor that it's this really high hurdle to start questioning somebody in an intense way that seems like you're dishonoring them. You know, it's really uncomfortable to even to really think about doing that in some ways. What you think about the implications that people would put on you, you know, the what your role then would be. All sorts of, it's very, very tricky.
We should say, Mike, for people who haven't read your piece this month, indeed, you met Chris Kyle and were working with him before he was tragically murdered. And were you doing the writing actually after the news of his death came out?
Right. So I met him last year. I was working on a story for about him for D Magazine. And it was going to be an in-depth look at basically what he was doing now since after the book came out, and kind of how he was trying to help his friends and troops and his various causes that he believed in. And then he died. And it changed the story significantly, obviously. And then we had to write it very, very quickly there to try and get into the April issue. And so it took on I then had to go back after he died and start looking into various things that we talked about in a way that now it's not just that we have this war hero. It's now that we have this fallen war hero.
A martyr.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I don't know exactly the right word. It's just uncomfortable in some ways as a journalist and exhilarating, right? You're looking into these really interesting and important stories, but it's also nerve-wracking.
Mm-hmm. Sean, in classic literature, is there such a thing as a hero martyr, or are they always triumphant? They never sort of die trying to achieve what they're doing, or do they?
I think that the triumphant version is probably the one the Americans most prefer, but the Greeks perfected the tragic hero, right? The hero of the epic. And it's always by trial. I mean, you look at somebody like Odysseus or Achilles. I mean, Achilles is kind of the exemplar of the Greek warrior hero, and he had to make a choice, either lead a long, healthy, happy life with children, or he would die in war and his name would live in infamy. And this concept of him going to a larger cause is what drew him to it. But the dark side is absolutely part of the hero myth, because even in terms of like today, it's most often the hero, it's in death is whenever the meaning of their lives are struggled with and kind of in some ways made larger than life. But in everyday life, we actually deal with the crooked timber of humanity, and that rarely is able to live up to these kind of mythic expectations. But that's part of how the model informs how we judge, you know, actual people's actions, as we've been seeing with Margaret Thatcher, how to memorialize her. Mm-hmm. And so this is a recurring question that the hero myth tries to give us guides for.
Why do we have such a hard time with people who fall into multiple categories? Why can't we admire somebody for one thing and say, I disagreed with that, and make peace with that?
I mean, I think Michael's experience points up some really interesting things and important things. I think the experience is happening on a couple of different levels. All right, you have the larger issue, which is the war, and whether you believe that war was just or not. That's an issue that's separate from what these individual men and women do in the course of doing their duty in a combat zone. I think the mistake our culture tends to make is we use the hero as a substitute for clear seeing and clear thinking about the issues that lead us to war and the conduct of the war. And so anytime a politician or a political party wants to, you know, hide behind, you know, what might be a damning truth, they trot out some heroes and they say, look, you know, here are the heroes. You know, they're Americans, we're Americans, and everything's okay. And don't look too closely at these issues. And then on the individual issue, and I think that's what you were really grappling with, Michael, in the Chris Kyle story. That is, I mean, Chris Kyle, he demonstrably did his duty as a soldier, and he took care of his people. And but there is a dark side to that. I mean, human experience is complex and ambiguous and confusing. And I think to truly honor that experience, it's up to us to examine it, you know, on all those levels.
It's almost like we're doing false correlations. We say, if we've decided this person is a hero and this person is associated with, we're talking here about the war, but it could be anything that we disagree about as a society. If this person is associated with this war, and we know that all heroes in our minds are always just and stand for the right thing, then we loop that around and we assume that we can let ourselves stop questioning the thing that might be troubling us.
Yeah, but that's also part of what the hero does, though, is the hero, whenever you see it through their eyes, they're the ones that are most reluctant to go to war. They're the ones that are the ones that pay the price for war. So they're the ones that are actually most qualified, not the politician. I mean, even in the Greek tales, this was a huge tension, right, between King Agamemnon, you know, ticking off Achilles, and Achilles is like, well, fine, I'll sit over here in my tent and good luck with your campaign. But I think that's one of the things is how the hero myth gets used versus how actual heroes and understanding something through their eyes sympathetically. I mean, I think that's really important because then you do understand the complexity of human nature, the human experience, and the complexities even of war and causes and noble duty. It's not uncomplicated.
And it seems like the when the question of whether to go to war does come up, it's always the politicians who have served in wars who seem to be the most reluctant to go to war. It's the politicians who haven't experienced war firsthand who seem more gung-ho and willing to plunge in.
That's because their expectations are colored by these kind of naive understandings, whereas someone that's been battle-hardened, you know, like Senator McCain comes to mind. I mean, he's one of the most eloquent and outspoken, you know, people about being very thoughtful and conscientious. So I think you're absolutely right.
One interesting thing that has persisted down through the ages is the idea that coming back from an epic adventure or a heroic action is always harder than people might imagine. And even today, it seems people struggle to make meaning of their lives, even the lives that they have missed greatly, when they get back to the real world of, you know, traffic signals and waiting in line at the ATM.
Yeah, when Chris Kyle got back, he was having a hard time doing things like going to the mall. It was really frustrating him to be at a traffic light and look over and see somebody just completely not thinking about a war, not thinking about and he would say things like, you know, I was 3 weeks ago, I was getting shot at, and now I'm in this completely separate world, which is, of course, and he understood that that is, of course, why, you know, why we have these troops, why we have people who are trained like that, so that we can secure a way of life that's comfortable and where people are not, you know, not thinking about the dangers of war constantly. And he knew those things, but it was still really frustrating. And then when he got out, he felt he had a cycle of depression. He was drinking more. He got out of shape. He had a really hard time. He knew exactly who replaced him. He knew that if that guy messed up and he died, he felt like it was on him. He felt like if that guy messed up and other people died, he felt like it was on him.
Mm-hmm.
And his entire purpose for years had been built about around being this warrior, being this this silent fighter who was on the side of good, who was, you know, going and killing bad guys. And when he came back, there was not that. There was, you know, a lot of other things in life, but not the one thing that had been his identity for a really long time. And so he struggled for a while to kind of turn, and then eventually turned, and the focus that he had put into training and being that, he found a way to find it, you know, to direct it a different purpose, to family, and then through, you know, helping people, and then through his business and that kind of stuff. But it really, he had a really hard time for a while, and he, you know, he didn't like going outside, he didn't like dealing with people, and it made him frustrated and angry, like really to just be around people who were so disconnected.
I mean, if you look at one of the foundational documents of Western culture, I mean, it's the Odyssey by Homer. And basically, if you boil the story down to one or two sentences, it's the story of soldiers trying to get home, and they can't find their way home. And I think Homer was onto something very profound there, and that is, I mean, literally Odysseus and his companions are having a hard time, you know, finding their way home, but the psychological aspect also. I think if you read it, you get the sense that a lot of Odysseus's companions had the equivalent of PTSD or shell shock.
We're talking about the meaning of the concept of hero in our culture. Ben Fountain is here. He's the author of the novel Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Sean Treat is assistant professor of rhetoric at the University of North Texas. Michael Mooney writes for D Magazine, and he has a profile of slain Navy sniper Chris Kyle in the current issue. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the meaning of heroism in Western literature and in 21st century American culture. My guests this hour are Michael Mooney, who wrote a profile of slain Navy sniper Chris Kyle for the current issue of D Magazine, novelist Ben Fountain, author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and Sean Treat, who's an assistant professor of rhetoric at the University of North Texas. You can be part of the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We tend to think of heroes as almost omnipotent, at least when they are in their sort of sphere of influence. One of the things, Ben, that I found most has come back to me most having thought about your novel is the idea that the people who are called heroes, Billy Lynn, is not in control of what people have decided he is, who people have decided he is.
Well, I mean, you know, contemporary American culture is this huge black hole that's constantly sucking in content and is always looking for storylines and easy to digest narratives. And so, yes, he feels himself, I mean, very much caught in that black hole. And he's trying to grapple with, you know, the image other people have of him, the public image, and then, you know, his own interior sense of himself, and which is a lot for anybody to handle, I think, but especially for a 19 or 20-year-old young man.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mike in Garland. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Chris. Thank you for your time today.
Sure.
I was thinking today, perfect opportunity, because earlier on I had a discussion regarding our society's concept of heroes, because I think we use that term so freely to describe so many people, and to me it boils down to heroic, those people that are situationally heroic, and those people who choose a heroic position or profession. For example, to me, my understanding is a firefighter has a heroic profession, but somebody who's a bystander, a pedestrian who comes across a burning building and runs in to save somebody or to assist in that situation would be heroic situationally. And the way that we tend to blend those in our society to be all-encompassing with that concept of what a hero is. And I was hoping that maybe your panel could discuss that.
Thanks for your call. Interesting distinction. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that is an important distinction, whether we're talking about a professional hero or even a professional soldier, as opposed to a soldier citizen, right? That the idea is that you're both at the same time. This is one of the reasons our founding fathers made a lot of hay about having a standing militia, right? Rather than a professional class. And you have a professional class of soldiers, such as samurai, et cetera. In our culture, I think that's one of the reasons we celebrate superheroes a lot. That's one of the courses I teach is the myth of the American superhero. And the premise is that our American notion of heroism is so highly romanticized, it takes all these versions, but it does so in a way that kind of glorifies redemptive violence, is that violence itself becomes redemptive. And I think that's what the caller is getting at, which I think spot on, is the idea of someone who's in a situation that requires heroism versus someone who's considered, you know, through the virtue of their character or some kind of vocation to be heroic 24/7.
Yeah, Chris Kyle would say, he's told people, I don't think of myself as a hero. I was doing a job. His own hero, Carlos Hathcock, a sniper from Vietnam, would say, I'm not a hero. I was just doing a job. He really felt like it was his occupation. You know, he felt like his job was pretty badass, but it was still just a job. You know, and that's what he was doing, and that's the way he thought of it.
I mean, that comes up over and over in talking to veterans and current service members. They say, I'm not a hero. I was just doing my job. Or, you know, when I go into combat, I'm not a hero. I'm just doing my job, the job I was trained for. And, you know, I don't know. I've thought about that a lot. And what is a hero? And I think, you know, in so many contexts, what I come down to is a hero is somebody who takes care of their people at some sacrifice to themselves.
You know, it's interesting, the term hero. We are eager to let people know that we appreciate what they've done for us as individuals or for us as a society. And it's almost like we assign this term to people without realizing how much weight it carries and that there is a dark side. We assume, gosh, I'd love to be called a hero, without really taking the time to contemplate the pressure of being considered a hero.
Well, I think that's what Michael was coming face-to-face with when you were spending time with Chris Kyle. And, I mean, how many confirmed, as they say, kills did he have? About 150?
From the Pentagon, 160.
It's a serious thing, the most serious thing you can think of, for one human being to kill another. And, you know, I don't care what the context is, it is a serious, profoundly grave thing to do. And, you know, what was in Chris Kyle that allowed him to do this 160 times? And not to take anything away from, you know, the service he did for the country and the way he protected his comrades, but I think if we want to come to a better understanding of human experience and what it means to be human, we've got to come face to face with those kinds of things.
Well, I think that's part of our earlier discussion about the Odyssey and what makes the Odyssey such a timeless classic that's much imitated, because it is about Odysseus's very long homecoming. I mean, it starts with the end of a war, and it's this long attempt to get back home. And this is not just the hero's journey, but this is a warrior's journey to come back to a place that's changed, and he's changed. Not even his own family recognize him upon his homecoming.
Only his dog.
And again, it really is. It's so, I mean, do you believe that was written as metaphor?
Well, all of the above. I mean, that's what some of the greatest literature does, and even journalism, is that this isn't just one person's story. This story is the story of kind of a generation who, on the one hand, we raise them to the status as heroes and we have yellow ribbons on the back of our cars, but do people actually keep up to date on a daily basis? Like, what's going on in the war? What's happening? What's the cost, right? Most people do not, and I can understand this soldier's kind of frustration with that obliviousness, that idea that it is their job. On the one hand, that demystifies it, but on the other hand, it becomes a kind of faux heroism. And,
you know, I wonder if it's more difficult for soldiers to come home from a war that has not been a collective effort. I mean, I think there's a distinction to be drawn between veterans of World War II and veterans of Vietnam and these two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. World War II was a collective effort. The entire American society mobilized, and the experience of combat or having a family member involved in combat, that was spread throughout society. And so I think when those soldiers came home, I think my suspicion is they came home to a broader understanding of what they had been through. Whereas with Vietnam and even more so with the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, these soldiers are coming home to a country that really made no collective sacrifice and that did not mobilize collectively. And it was a very small segment of society that you know, did the fighting in these wars. And so I've got to believe that makes them feel more detached from the society they're coming back to.
So do you think, Ben, that we're sort of assuaging our guilt for not collectively mobilizing by calling someone a hero, you know, regardless of what their job was? And I want to be careful here, because I mean no disrespect. I have extraordinary gratitude for the men and women who serve in the armed forces.
Absolutely, yeah.
In every position, whether it's peeling potatoes or whether it is on the front lines and, you know, living in really dangerous conditions all the time and potentially making the ultimate sacrifice. But do we devalue the really extraordinary acts of certain individuals by automatically saying everyone's a hero? Does it not feel genuine to anyone to be called a hero if they know that everyone else is a hero too?
Well, I don't think it even rises to the level of conscious guilt in most of us. I think there's this aspect of oh, I'm going to approach this service member. I'm going to thank them for their service, thank them for their sacrifice. You know, say you're a real hero to me, and then I'm going to go on about my life.
And I'm done, right?
And there's this self-congratulatory aspect to it. Well, I'm a real patriot because I just went up and gave this soldier a pep talk and told him or her how much I appreciate them. I mean, how much can our words really mean if we don't know what we're talking about?
On the other hand, there are a lot of, I mean, that it does make people feel better, you know, when they hear that, when they're in an airport, when they're at a restaurant and somebody comes up and buys them a meal because, you know, just to say thank you, it does make them feel better. And it makes them feel like, you know, some of their loss may have been for something if they felt like previously it may not have been. And in Chris Kyle's case, when he was fighting, you know, he followed politics to a decent degree, but he was fighting for his friends. He was fighting for his teammates. The way he looked at it is if somebody had a gun and was going to hurt somebody that he cared about, no other circumstance mattered. He was going to take care of that and end that immediately.
Well, let's also recognize how he died, and that was helping other soldiers make the difficult transition
exactly.
coming back. I mean, when you talk about – Ben, I think you're right. I mean, part of what this does is we also, on the one hand, raise them up as heroes, but on the other hand, your chances of being homeless or things like that are – huge, like two times what an average person is for veterans.
One out of every three homeless people in America is a veteran of a war. And so there you have the odyssey again. These are soldiers who can't – they are literally homeless. They can't find their way home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ray in Dallas. Hi, Ray.
Hello. I'd like to ask about Joseph Campbell's kind of hero journey. I am probably in the minority and have just recently in the past year discovered Joseph Campbell and his work at looking at mythology and this concept that we're all the hero of our own life's journey. So I'd like to ask our panelists, possibly the novelist and the professor, what they think about this concept of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey and how it might fit into the conversation and our idea of 21st century heroism.
Thank you so much for your call. And for people who are not familiar, and please jump in if I'm getting this wrong, but essentially Campbell identified the common elements to hero narratives from all over the world that seem to resound in different accounts mm-hmm. of heroes, regardless of sort of where they were written or by whom.
Yeah, the hero with a thousand faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think these days maybe it's not so much that we're the hero of our own life journey. It's that we're the star of our own movie, you know, the movie of our
celebrity
life.
Celebrity culture. Yeah.
No, that's it. But this was Campbell, of course, being a good Union. What he's doing is he's understanding these as these archetypal tutelary figures, that these help us go through stages in our lives where we do cast ourselves as protagonists, right? But this gives us a model to both live up to, but it also gives us a model, a formula for maturity. And that's one of the big criticisms that Campbell had. I mean, he had a great interaction with Bill Moyers that was published in a book called The Power of Myth, where they go back and forth and he talks about one of the difficulties with the American version of this hero myth is that it's perpetually stuck in adolescence, right? It never moves forward. And this idea of maturity becomes something very, very difficult for a relatively young country making sometimes what seems like very kind of adolescent type of decisions. So it's real fascinating to contrast the older hero, right, to maturity, someone like an Odysseus, versus our own younger hero sets that are all perpetually stuck, you know, like our superheroes, somewhere between 25 and 33.
Well, stuck in adolescence because we sort of never get over the, you know, the vindictive power of violence. Is that the reason?
Well, that's one theory. And the other theory is that the American version, because it's so, you know, unapologetically optimistic, is that there are certain things that it doesn't allow for. This is where we get Disney versions of myths, right, that always have the happy ending and the singing birds, whenever the actual epic hero myths are far more complicated.
Pocahontas dies of smallpox in real life.
Exactly. And so, but this is part of, like, does the myth help us cope with the harshness of realities, or does it help distract us from those?
Is it a false myth or a true myth? Right. You know, one thing that's striking about recent American history is that America is always losing its innocence. And
what a profound statement. America is always losing its innocence.
It's like we're the perpetual virgin. you know, with the John F. Kennedy assassination, you know, loss of innocence. And then with the Vietnam War, loss of innocence, the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, loss of innocence, Watergate, loss of innocence, revelations about the dirty wars in Central America during the 1980s, loss of innocence, and 9/11, loss of innocence. I mean, when are we going to finally become wise and move beyond innocence to something like, you know, experiential wisdom. And I think, you know, we're still struggling toward that.
Well, it starts to sound like, you know, when you lay it out that way, it starts to sound like we're really just deliberately ignorant.
I'm not going to argue with that.
Sometimes, but I mean, sometimes it's also that, you know, and this was a theme of the Dark Knight movies, you know, the comforting lie, right? The noble lie is what Plato called it, versus these kinds of harsh, complex, nuanced, tragic realities and making mistakes. I mean, you know, we have people that say, I believe in America, right or wrong. And technically that's jingoism. I'm not sure that that's doing any service to the people that then have to go out there and, you know, cash the militaristic check for, you know, for that.
And modern heroes exist. I mean, they exist for society, right? The big, large-scale hero exists not just to honor that person, but it exists for the people who are doing the honoring, right? In Chris Kyle's case, it's the thousands and thousands of people who line the streets and show up at his memorial. They're doing that to honor him, but also to make a statement about themselves, to, mm-hmm. you know, it – whether it's they believe we're in really hard times right now, there's, you know, like it's like the Dark Knight, there's really difficult economic times, we're in two wars, you know, there's all these reasons to feel bad about anything, let alone the country. And so they need somebody that, you know, epitomizes all of the things that they believe in, the strength of the country, the willingness to do whatever it takes to, in theory, do the right thing. You know, just somebody who can handle that kind of pressure and still be an upstanding citizen and a good mm-hmm. family member. You know, all these things that we, you know, idolize as a culture, you know, we need people who we can put that on so we believe that it exists no matter what.
Right. But that's also got to be something that we then use to aspire to, right? I mean, this is right. one of the things with the Greek hero cults. I mean, this is literally what happened to heroes. They turned into cults, and these cults were rife with internal contradictions because some people wanted to just lionize the hero and then sit back comfortably and do as they do, whereas the hero and those stories actually challenge us to contemplate and consider how we can live fully and up to our stated values.
Sean Treat is with us. He's assistant professor of rhetoric at the University of North Texas. Ben Fountain is here as well, author of the novel Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. And Michael Mooney of D Magazine, who for this month's issue wrote a profile of slain Navy sniper Chris Kyle. We will come back to the conversation about the meaning of heroism in modern America in just a moment. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about the nature of heroism in classic Western literature and in 21st century America with my three guests for the hour, novelist Ben Fountain, author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, journalist Michael Mooney of D Magazine, and Sean Treat, who is assistant professor of rhetoric at the University of North Texas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Do we need heroes in a different way as we become a country that, at least by certain accounts, is less tied to traditional religious narratives than we once were?
Yeah, that's part of what some of the arguments that the superhero functions in. It's a secularization of what are essentially these kinds of religiously charged myths.
God-like properties.
Yeah. Exactly. But that's also where the convention of the secret identity comes in, because they're also, right, have all these extraordinary powers, but they have this other...
They're just like you and they understand
exactly.
your life.
Yes, right. And that's part of what superheroes, I think, help function to do. And I don't think it's a coincidence that since 9/11 we've had an explosion of superhero films and cinema as a response, because we really are seeking these much more complicated, complex heroes as ways to kind of think about what we think heroism is in these new changing conditions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, man, what a great conversation. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, there's been such an interesting kind of back and forth and overreaching idea of what this idea of hero is. And again, with what I'm about to say, I have the highest respect for anybody who chooses to lay their life on the line to, you know, defend the country or an idea or anything that that has to do with that. But my idea more is along the lines of how I feel like the definition of hero has changed, particularly for who I feel like it impacts the most. And that's our kids and our young adults. It seems to me that if you really want to put the idea of a hero in the idea of who someone might aspire to be, man, it's hard not to look at who is most recently being glorified or reflected in popular culture and the media, regardless of whether it's any of these reality TV show stars, et cetera, so forth and so on. They tend to, at least in my kids' social circles, and I feel like we're pretty average, they tend to get a lot of press, you know, in between each other. And so that is interesting and obviously troubling to me.
Are you talking about, like, athletes and celebrities and actors and that sort of thing?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and again, it just whoever happens to be getting the most play in social media or just in the media, popular media in general.
Yeah, I think those are interesting points, and it makes me think about Lance Armstrong.
Well, you know, I think heroes these days most often in our society are used to sell something. And so, I mean, athletes, they get used to sell all kinds of things. I mean, everything from, you know, toilet lids to sports cars. And, you know, celebrities, they're you know, pushing their movies, their TV shows, all the products that are associated, you know, with advertising on their shows. And then you come to military heroes. And I think there's a strong argument to be made that in the past 10 years, they have been used by some very astute, canny politicians to sell these wars to the American people.
Well, it's not just politicians. The Oscars this year, the movies that were big in the Oscars were CIA agents.
Oh, right on.
They were, you know, these were movies that the Pentagon openly worked with the studios. Mm-hmm. You know, they were okay. They were selling this idea that America has the ability to do something badass, mm-hmm. has something incredible. I should stop using that word.
Thank you for that.
But there's also the element of that, thus it has always been, in kind of a way. I mean, because when we look back, I can even look back to my childhood and, I'm going to date myself here, but Top Gun and, you know, Heartbreak Ridge with Clint Eastwood, John Wayne made, you know, movies that were basically propaganda. I mean, and this is where we run into some of the difficulties with how these hero myths then become commodified. They're turned into branding. They're ways to help promote and sell.
And it becomes a closed loop because, you know, by reinforcing this notion of the hero, for the next entity or person to come along, they can leverage that value up and get even more value out of, you know, following the hero myth.
But it's also a long ways to fall because people like Lance Armstrong, Tiger Woods, I mean, they did build up and they become almost heroified in terms of a brand image. But look how far that can go wrong.
Well, and if you take Lance Armstrong and Oscar Pistorius, people who were both superb athletes, but also part of their narrative was that they had a physiological struggle that most of us hope will never happen to us. So I didn't follow their stories extremely closely, but maybe we ignored things along the way. Certainly that appears to have been the case with Lance Armstrong. We ignored things along the way that got in the way of that. But then once the evidence is out there, it's really easy if you go back to the superhero idea to turn them into the villain, right? Suddenly they're like the Joker, and I'm naming all dumb villains. My kids would be so embarrassed. But, you know, it's not so hard to jump them into the other category.
No, this is one of the things that's difficult when you're considering mythology is that one group's charismatic hero can be another group's charismatic supervillain.
Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln.
Correct. I mean, and this also goes back to, you know, the issue of how these symbols get used, how they get mobilized, because I'm also thinking of people like Private Jessica Lynch and mm-hmm. Pat Tillman, who I consider to be another one of these genuine kind of American hero soldiers.
But used as a symbol.
But how they then become used and actually more accurately, misused, and intentionally and strategically misused. And there's plenty of evidence for that. But at the same time, we're so hungry for these myths that it also makes us a little jaded about it.
That's exactly right. Are they being served or are they being consumed? You know, these we have a self-serve culture. You know, people seek out their own heroes, too. You know, they identify their heroes as people who reflect their own values, their own cultures. So when you have a hero that is famous for being a good athlete or famous for being rich or famous for being good looking or some combination of those, you know, what is that saying about our culture? What is that saying about the people who identify those people as heroes? And when you have part of society that has their heroes as the rich people and the good looking people, it's interesting. The word villain actually evolves from meaning poor people. Right. Those were the poor people, the peasants, you know, that's in some ways that's who we villainize, or at least that's who parts of our society villainizes right now. Poor people, you know. That's.
And then there is the complicating factor. And we'll bring this back to you, Mike, because, of course, you had the complicating factor of Chris Kyle's murder while you were working on the story. Yesterday, we had the death of Margaret Thatcher, and she is a hero to some and a villain to others. But in the immediate aftermath of the death of a person that many people knew, it's sort of hard to speak openly and critically at the same time because it seems very disrespectful.
Well, that's a challenge, but that's also the challenge that these hero myths give us. I mean, that's part of what we do is we do have to evaluate their actions. Because you're right. I mean, just as Margaret Thatcher was a divisive figure, that also brings up a much needed conversation, right, about how this past impacts our present and how are we to judge this? I mean, which actions are noble, which things are to be avoided, which things worked, which things didn't. So it opens up a conversation, which, you know, this is why as a communication studies professor, these hero myths fascinate me because to concentrate on one particular political figure becomes a very divisive. But then to contextualize it within this idea of mythology, political mythology and otherwise, suddenly they become licensed to be able to think about the ways that these guide our thinking and how we can interact with it to think more sharply about what we believe and what our convictions are.
I mean, this may go back to the fundamental principle underlying democracy, and that is, I mean, well, democracy is government by the governed. In other words, you know, the majority of people decide who they want their leaders to be. And I think the underlying premise is that over time, the majority of people in their collective wisdom will make the correct choices so that society can progress. And there will be more good for more people. If we start cutting off conversations, if we start cutting off examination of the hard issues of being human, I mean, how are we going to learn? And I mean, we never know enough about who we are and what we do. And so I think anything that keeps the conversation going and getting more profound is good. And anything that is used as a substitute for thinking where it just closes off the conversation, I think that's a real threat to democracy.
Well, and in the absence of those difficult conversations and, you know, continuing to sort of drill down to actual fact, then the mythology grows, right? The less complicating information we have, the more we can take, for example, the founding fathers. You know, now we understand that they held slaves, that they sometimes cheated on their wives, that they did things that we might not consider very heroic today, if not downright reprehensible. But if we don't look for the things that kind of irritate our sensibilities, we get stuck with just cardboard cutouts.
You know, I think we have to recognize our own flawed nature and the darkness in each and every one of us. And I think coming to grips with the reality of these people and these situations is, I think we do ourselves a real disservice if we don't come to grips.
I agree. I think that's the highest tribute we can pay. I mean, that's why I really appreciated your piece on the sniper in the D. I thought it was really well done because I think it does capture complexity. And I mean, that's to me, that's the highest tribute is like, this is not a cartoon. This is not a cardboard cutout. This is a very complex person, complex motives, complex loyalties. And that to me is what starts conversations.
And this is how society deals with stories too, right? First, you know, when we have a story that, whether it's a news story or a fable or anything, first we deal with it on its face. We have an emotional reaction. We have some initial reaction. Then we analyze it further. Then, you know, as a story evolves through society, there's the reverse of the story. You know, we have the anti-hero. We have a play based right. on the villain of
Wizard
of Oz.
Witch,
you know,
right
exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all sorts of ways that we deal with stories as they evolve, and as we evolve with them, that's just the way it works.
Right.
What did you hear from readers, Mike, after the piece came out?
Most people felt like it honored this, like they enjoyed it. They felt like that it honored Chris Kyle. And they felt like it gave a human perspective. A couple people were upset that there were, you know, various aspects. It's a long story. So, and I got a decent amount of emails. So people were upset at all sorts of things, right? You know, he was a guy who killed a lot of people. There's a lot of people who are upset at that anybody in society would even refer to that person as a hero. Because in their mind, that's just something that you don't do no matter what any circumstance. And that's, you know, there's a lot of people who have that belief too. That's,
You know, one thing that was really striking about his memorial service at Cowboys Stadium was, well, there are a lot of things that were striking about it. I mean, the slideshow of his life on the Jumbotron.
Wow.
But what really, and I still haven't gotten my head around this. What really got my attention was his casket sitting there at midfield on the Cowboys star.
With the American flag on it.
With the American flag. And
the symbolism that is mixed up in that is astonishing.
And I can't.
And triumphal music.
And there's something in me that distrusts that profoundly, but I can't figure out why I distrust it. But I will say, the day after his memorial service, a veteran friend of mine called up and went on about a 30-minute, I won't say rant or screed, but very intense monologue on that whole visual. And I could tell that he was trying to get his head around it. Why did it bother him? Should it bother him? And yet I think, you know, maybe what he was feeling like was that, was Chris Kyle being used in some unseemly way?
See, when you think about then policies of not showing our American service dead being unloaded off of planes in their flag-draped coffins, this becomes disconcerting. Because what it's doing is it's valorizing and I think maybe dangerously romanticizing in a way.
I should say his memorial was organized by his friends, by, you know, SEALs, by people who are really close to him. And in a place that, you know, he loved the Cowboys. He loved. Mm-hmm. So there was all these things, you know, whether he would have been comfortable with that
or
not.
Yeah, should we even be concerned about it? I don't know. Yeah. But it was just, it was such a striking visual and it seemed to resonate in a lot of ways, and I still haven't figured out my own reaction.
I don't know exactly what to think of it either. It was it's an incredible image, though.
Well, you know, given your earlier comments, because usually most veterans do approach it with the utmost humility. This is my job. I'm doing this. I'm here to serve my country, all these noble causes, and that's what's worthy of respect. I think it's just an element of the spectacle that sometimes makes people a little distrustful, because perhaps all of our soldiers deserve exactly these kinds of recognition.
Sean Treat is Assistant Professor of Rhetoric at the University of North Texas. Ben Fountain is the author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk. Michael Mooney is with D Magazine and wrote a profile of slain Navy sniper Chris Kyle for the current issue of the magazine. Guys, I love a show that leaves me with as many questions as answers, so thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks.
Thanks very much for listening. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Thank you.